I'd like to start, as everyone does, by thanking the organizers for inviting me. And I'd also like to thank the organizers for something else. Because I've been to many conferences where you go to the talks and you discover that the talks actually don't have much to do with the theme of the conferences. But somehow, it seems like just about every speaker so far has actually talked about open problems in conferences. And I don't know what it is you did. Maybe it's the fierce expressions on your faces if we didn't talk about open problems, but people are doing it, and I will as well. Though also speaking about the ferocity of the organizers, I would like to remind the speakers that we were asked at the very beginning of the conference to provide the PDF files for our slides to the organizers. And that is a good idea, because when I'm going to talks that are like this, I tend not to take notes because I'm trusting that I will be able to revisit the slides. And because I practice what I preach, if you go to my webpage and go to my slide talks, you can actually, while you're listening to me, whoops. There. You can actually watch the slides on your own computer. So. I expect Dan to be doing that, by the way. So yes, I wanted to talk about some various problems having to do with Loginus curves over finite fields. And it turns out that, you know, even though I intended to talk about quite a variety of problems, one particular one kind of expanded to fill much of the talk. And that is a collection of problems having to do with something that I'm going to call the elliptic curve construction problem, which I think some people are interested in. So this problem is, if someone gives you an integer n and a prime power q and asks you to find an elliptic curve over fq that has exactly n points. So, nice basic problem. And I'm going to talk about generalizations of this, variants of it, and generalizations of variants of it. And at the very end, I'll say something about lattices with that. So first of all, before you worry about constructing an elliptic curve with a given number of points, you might want to make sure that there exists an elliptic curve with that number of points. Unfortunately, this problem, the elliptic curve existence problem, is easy to solve. If you set t to be t plus 1 minus n, then the values of t that come from elliptic curves are the following. You get every t that whose square is less than 4q, and that is coprime to q. If q is not a square, you also get the integers in the set, so you'll always get 0. If q is a power of 2, then you get square root of 2q and minus square root of 2q. And if q is a power of 3, you get plus or minus square root of 3q. And finally, if q is a square, you always get plus or minus 2 square root of q, and you also get these other values depending on some congruences of the characteristic of the field. So it's very easy to answer this question. And it's actually kind of important to know that you can answer this question because kind of the most naive algorithm for constructing an elliptic curve with n points over a field is this naive solution. Given a q and an n, you check to make sure that n happens. Then you pick an elliptic curve and check to see whether it has n points and repeat. So it's very, very important to do step one if you're going to do this algorithm. If you do, then the time it will take is I say O tilde of q over the square root of 4q minus t squared. And I should say what I mean by O tilde. So this is supposed to be a big O, but the tilde means a number of things. First of all, that I'm going to ignore multiplicative factors that are, say, logarithmic in the main term. And I'm also going to assume that I can, you know, make any kind of heuristic assumptions that I need to get that answer. And basically, it means, you know, that it has no meaning, but roughly that is, you know, what you expect the runtime to be. Whereas the average runtime is going to be O tilde of square root of q. That actually you can prove.
Sorry, what are you averaging over?
Oh, I'm sorry, averaging for a fixed q, averaging over n, and then letting q go to infinity.
What about the deterministic version?
Well, I suppose you could do that too, yeah. There are less naive solutions. So the CM method is one of those. Given a q and an allowable n, you can compute the, well, I'm going to assume that this n gives you a trace, which is coprime to q. Otherwise, there are other things you can do. But you, given this n and this q, you compute the Hilbert class polynomial of the discriminant t squared minus 4q. You find a root of this polynomial over fq. And then you compute the elliptic curves having this j as their j invariant, and one of those will have the right number of points. So the running time for this is O tilde of the absolute value of this discriminant. Because this first step, just writing down this f, it takes that amount of time, because the size of that f is about the delta bits. So the average running time for this algorithm, again averaging over n's, is O tilde of q. So in fact, for a randomly chosen n, this is worse than the naive algorithm. But if your delta is small, then it's better. And combining these two methods, you find out that, well, the best thing to do is, if your discriminant is bigger than q to the 2/3, you should use the naive method. And if it's smaller, then use the CM method. And the running time for this combined method, again, averaged, is q to the 2/3. Well, not average, I'm sorry. In the worst case, it's q to the 2/3. So the first open problem really is, you know, this cannot stand. We need something better to do this. This is just really, really awful. But it's really awful, but you may have heard of some recent work by Rainer Broeker and Peter Stavenhagen, and the one-line summary of their work is that given an integer n, they can produce for you in expected polynomial time an elliptic curve that has n points. So how does that jive with what I'm saying here? That's because Broeker and Stavenhagen, well, cheating is such a harsh word. but they changed the question. So instead of having q being part of the input, they have q being part of the output. So given an n, they find a q, an elliptic curve over f q, that has n points. And the idea is that since you expect to have, there's this question of how many primes there are at short intervals, but you expect that there will be a prime q such that when you compute this discriminant, d squared minus 4q, it'll be a big square times a small fundamental discriminant. And if that's the case, then instead of computing the Hilbert-class polynomial for delta, you compute it for delta naught. And since this delta naught has size big O of log squared n, you can do all this in polynomial time. I suppose I should say they require that your n be given to you in factored form, but okay, so that's the elliptic curve construction problem. And I want to talk about generalizations of this to curves of higher genus. And the first problem you face when you're trying to generalize this question is to figure out exactly what was the question. And I started out by saying, given an n and a q, find a genus 1 curve with n points. So that's one possible version of the question. Another possible version of the question is that maybe you want to find a genus 1 curve whose Jacobian has n points. Same thing. Or perhaps really what you want to do is find a genus 1 curve whose Wey polynomial, by which I mean the characteristic polynomial of Frobenius endomorphism, maybe you want to specify what that Wey polynomial should be and try and find a elliptic curve with that Wey polynomial. So those are three possible interpretations of the elliptic curve construction problem. And unfortunately, none of them gets any easier if you go to higher genus. So let's see what happens when you try. So first, the naive method, because on average, that was the best thing we knew how to do. So if you want to find a curve of genus 1, 2, or 3 that has a given number of points, then the good news is that it doesn't get that much worse than it did for elliptic curves. Of course, you have to count points on a curve, but we all know that's polynomial time, so that's just fine. Finding a curve whose Jacobian has a given number of points using the naive method, that is going to grow like essentially the number of possible values for the number of points on the Jacobian, doing this at random. So the naive method for genus 2 will take time q to the 3 halves. And if you specify the Wey polynomial for genus 2 curves, it's going to be about the same time as computing the it's finding a curve with a given number of points in the Jacobian. But for a genus 3 curve, it's harder to find a given Wey polynomial than it is to find a given number of points in the Jacobian. Yeah?
Sorry, you mentioned that step 1 was crucial for the algorithm.
Yes.
But what about step 1 here?
I will get to that. That's going to be a generalization of a variant of the problem, so that's later in that. But we can do more than just the naive method. There's the analog for genus 2 of the CN method for elliptic curves, which Kristen spoke about. But to estimate the complexity of that algorithm, we need to know how big these Agusa class polynomials she was talking about are. And, well, we can at least say that the degree of those things should be about the size of the minus class number, H minus, of the reflex field of the CM field, which is in fact about the same size as the minus class number of the CM field itself, which is size O tilde of cube of 3 halves. So this is kind of like in the elliptic curve case, the degree of the polynomial is the same as the complexity of the naive method, which means that the size of the coefficients just makes things worse. And I don't know what the size of the coefficients is. Kristen thought that it might be something like O tilde of Q cubed, and there the tilde must be important because she wasn't sure. So if it actually is that big, then this CM method is just horrible in general. And again, you want to see if you could find small discriminants and then you can actually make it work. And you can ask, can you do like a Broca-Stapenhagen trick for genus 2 curves? Seems like a natural thing to try.
Sorry, is that Q cubed for the total size of all coefficients or for each? Wouldn't each coefficient look like the class number?
Yeah, that was meant for each.
So total size, you know?
Yeah, so I don't know anything about this. I'm just hearing what I'm reporting what I heard. So the individual coefficients are that big?
Yeah.
Q cubed is the relative discriminant of the field. So if you know otherwise, Dan, then I would like to find out.
There's a lot more than relative.
Yeah.
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 Okay, so we can still ask if we can get a small discriminant. And so to answer that question, I need to set up some notation. So for a given value of n, you can try and figure out how many q's are there so that n is at least, you know, in the allowable range for the size of the Jacobian. And there are about n to the 1/4, really it's n to the 1/4 over a logarithmic factor, but about n to the 1/4 possible q's, each of them near the square root of n. And for each q, there are at most 5 Weil polynomials that can give rise to a given n. And each of those Weil polynomials will define for you a CM field K. So this is a totally imaginary number field that is a degree 2 extension of a totally real number field, which is itself a quadratic extension of Q. Sitting inside of K, you have the ring of integers. In K plus, you have its ring of integers, and you have Z, ring of integers of Q. But you also have some kind of natural orders sitting inside of these maximal orders. So if you let pi be a root of f in k, then you have this ring, z adjoint pi and the complex conjugate of pi. You have this subring of o plus, which is z adjoint pi plus pi bar. And these are kind of important things to keep track of when you're working with the CM methods. So I need to refer to some quantities here. This delta o minus is going to be the norm from k to q of the relative class number of k over k plus. And the delta O plus is going to be the discriminant. Oh, did I say relative class number? I meant relative discriminant of k over k plus. And the delta O plus will be the discriminant of k plus. And the delta R minus and delta R plus are the same things with O replaced by R in these locations. But the difference is that for the delta R minus and delta R plus, we can actually figure out what they are in terms of the coefficients of the Weil polynomial. So the degree of the Agusa polynomials grows like the minus class number of K. And the minus class number, it grows like, assuming things, it grows like the square root of the discriminant of k divided by the discriminant of k plus, which turns out to be that quantity. So we want this class number to be small. And one thing that we know is this product, you know what that is. So what we want is that we want r and r plus both to have large conductors in their maximal orders. And that would imply that there are large square factors in this product. So we would like there to be large. just having large square factors in that product might not be enough to ensure that this is small, but it's necessary. So now the question is, how large a square factor can we expect there to be in the n to the 1/4 possible values for this that we have? So here are some heuristics which stem from discussions with Kristen and Peter Stavenhagen we had over lunches in San Diego, but I will take full responsibility for all of the errors in here. If you view this product as a random integer that's big, you ask, what is the largest square factor we can expect when we choose n to the 1/4 such integers? And the answer is going to be roughly f squared, where f is this size, the same size as the number of integers we have. So that means that you expect this thing, which was going to be this divided by its square factor, expect that to be of size n to the 3/2 divided by n to the 1/2. So that's bad news, because that means that the degree of the Agusa polynomials will be square root of n. And if the coefficients are anything more than n to the 1/4 bits long, which they almost certainly are, then this is worse than using the naive method. So this is saying that instead of using a Broca-Stavenhagen trick, you might as well just pick your favorite field and look for curves that have that many points on the Jacobi. So this is also a depressing situation, and I guess the other open problem, which I haven't actually spelled out here, is find a better way of doing this. Okay, so this has been a little frustrating, that all the open problems look very hard. So why don't we try and find something easier to do, and this will also answer Igor's question. Why don't we try to generalize an easier question? So the elliptic curve existence problem was nice and simple. Why don't we see if we can generalize that to curves of higher genus? So here's the problem. Suppose you have a polynomial of this form, because characteristic polynomials are of that form. And suppose that it's the Bay polynomial of an isogeny class of abelian surfaces. Does there exist a Jacobian with this Bay polynomial? So to the best of my knowledge, the first time this appeared in print was in a paper by Rook in 1990, though surely someone must have thought of it before. It's a natural question. And I should mention that this hypothesis, that you're given something which is the Bay polynomial of an isogeny class of abelian surfaces, that is easy to answer using the Honda-Tate theorem. So we can at least make sure that we have a polynomial which comes from an abelian surface. And we just want to know whether it comes from a Jacobian. And the key to answering this is a result of Vey, which states that an abelian surface over an algebraically closed field is a Jacobian, if and only if it has an irreducible principal polarization. And over finite fields, you find out that an abelian surface is over FQ is a Jacobian on a curve over FQ, if and only if it has a geometrically irreducible principal polarization. So I guess the main thing is that there's no problem with descent here. This will work. So using that, you can come up with a solution to the genus 2 existence problem. This is something that I worked on with Henrik Nard and Christoph Ritzenthaler. Using many other results, so there are some results by Edelman and Wang, earlier results of my own from my thesis, work of Lauder and Serre, work of Meissner, who was a student of Nard's, McGuire and Volok answered one of the cases, Rook himself, when he posed this question, provided some sufficient conditions. And I can tell you what the answer is. So suppose we're given a Bay polynomial of an isogeny class. There it is. If the surfaces in the isogeny class are not simple, if they're isogenous to a product of elliptic curves, then you can write this F as a product of two Bay polynomials of elliptic curves. So if they're not simple, do that. So here is a table having to do with what happens when you have a split Jacobian. And, I'm not going to go through this. The slides are available online. Go through this at your leisure. But the things to notice are that, let's look at some of these conditions. There's conditions on the P rank of the surfaces. Here, there's no condition. Here, there's no condition on P and Q. It's just that if the middle coefficients of these factors differ by 1, and then you don't have a Jacobian. That's one thing. There are other things if you have an ordinary abelian surface, and if the two middle coefficients of the factors are equal, and this quantity lies in this small set, then you don't have a Jacobian. continues on down. But the thing to notice is that, first of all, the supersingular cases, the P rank zero cases, are the ones that take up most of the space on the table, that are most annoying. And the other way of finding the annoying cases is to notice that the cases where the characteristic is two or three also take up most of the table. So if you're only interested in ordinary curves, in fact, it's very simple to answer. And for almost ordinary curves, there's just one case, which is, in fact, what McGuire and Bullock answered. And so these are if any one of these rows is satisfied, then you don't have a Jacobian in the isogeny class. And conversely, if none of these rows is satisfied, then you do have a Jacobian. And likewise, there's a table for the simple Jacobians, which I won't particularly go. Well, actually, I do want to point out a couple of things. First of all, again, it's the supersingular cases which are most annoying. It's also the supersingular cases is the case that gave us a surprise when we were proving this, because this condition is not something which you naturally guess. The other thing is that even though we have these nice tables, and in some sense we've answered the question, there's this condition here. And the problem with this condition is that the only way I know of checking it involves factoring a number of size cubed. So in fact, even though we have an answer to this question, we don't have a polynomial time answer to this question. So that is already, you can hear the ominous music when you think about generalizing to genus 3. Things might get even worse. Okay, so cue the ominous music. So let's think about this for genus 3. What can we say about this? So the analogous problem is, suppose you have a Weyl polynomial of an Abelian threefold. How can you tell if there's a Jacobian for this Weyl polynomial? And the analog of this result of Weyl that we used before is a result of Oort and Ueno after Hoyt, who proved this thing for algebraically closed fields of characters at zero, I believe. An Abelian threefold over an algebraically closed field is a Jacobian, if and only if it has an irreducible principal polarization. So just like for genus 2 curves. But when you try to go down to a finite field, there is a complication. So it is still true that a Jacobian has a geometrically irreducible principal polarization. But if someone gives you an Abelian threefold with a geometrically irreducible principal polarization, you don't automatically know it's a Jacobian. It's either a Jacobian or a quadratic twist of a Jacobian. And the reason this happens suppose you have a non-hyperelliptic genus 3 curve, C, over a field K. Then the automorphism group with the Jacobian of C is bigger than the automorphism group of C. You have plus or minus 1 acting on a Jacobian. It's a group, after all, so negative 1 certainly acts. And if you apply Galois cohomology to this isomorphism, you find that, This group is not necessarily abelian, so this is a pointed set. But this pointed cohomology set is in bijection with this pointed cohomology set across this one. And this one parameterizes the twists of the Jacobian, this one parameterizes the twists of C, and this one parameterizes the quadratic extensions of K. So what this is saying is that giving a twist of a Jacobian is the same as giving a twist of the curve plus twist of, a quadratic extension of K. And the upshot is that Jacobians have more twists than the curves do. Typically, there will be no twists of C, that the automorphism group will be trivial, and you'll have, over a finite field, you'll have two twists of the Jacobian. So, a twist at a principally polarized variety is a principally polarized variety, so you're just stuck. You have to determine whether or not you have a twist. So this is what I'm going to call a half-open problem. Given a principally polarized Abelian threefold over a field K, determine whether or not it is a Jacobian over K. And actually, there's a related question which comes up when you think about this. How do you give someone a principally polarized Abelian threefold? So here are two solutions in progress that I know of. I don't know all the details of these, but Steve Mayer is a student of Yat-Tok in Birmingham, and he, in characteristic zero, he has shown that there is an explicit weight 18 modular form, chi 18. On the moduli space, a principally polarized abelian threefolds provided with level four structure. If you take this modular form and divide it by the 36th power of the zeroth theta null, you get a modular function, and the quadratic character of the value of this function on a given point in the moduli space tells you whether or not you have a Jacobian or not. So he's still working on this. He says he's 70% sure. Another approach is given by Christoph Ritzenthaler, and he has kind of been working on this, and I asked him by email, could you tell me more about it, and he said essentially no. So this is essentially all I know. He hasn't had time to write it up yet, so or even an email. So, but the idea is that somehow you must be giving him his principally polarized abelian threefold in some kind of geometric way. So you're giving it as something embedded in, which I don't know how you do. But somehow he manages to construct a quadric in P3 from whatever geometric data he's asking of you. And the quadratic character of the determinant of this quadric is what tells you whether or not you have Jacobian or not.
Is this quadric the quadric that contains the... If it's a Jacobian,
the quadric? I don't know.
That's
you know perhaps so likely, but that's he didn't say anything else. So I don't know. But if both of us bother him, so the problem is I don't know if either of these things, nice as they are, as little as I know about them as I do, I don't know whether they can actually help us answer the question, at least in the ways that I'm used to thinking about them. So. If someone gives you a Weyl polynomial of an isogeny class of abelian threefolds, then, and if we say, just to make life easy, that the threefolds are ordinary abelian threefolds and they're, say, absolutely simple, then we can understand the entire isogeny class, including the polarization, including the polarizations, in terms of these things that are called Deligne modules, which you get by taking the varieties and characteristics in characteristic P, lifting them to characteristic zero, and then you get CM varieties and characteristic zero. Then you look at the first homology, which is the module over Z adjoined pi by bar. And you can kind of understand everything in terms of number theory, for just given this Weyl. And the open problem I want to say is, can either of the approaches that I mentioned on the preceding slide, can either of those fit in with this Deligne module understanding of the isogeny class, so that you can actually answer the question that I asked earlier. Is there a Jacobian in the isogeny class? Okay, so that's actually all I want to say about the elliptic curve construction problem and its generalizations and stuff. And partly inspired by some of the talks that have occurred in this conference and will occur in this conference, I want to talk about some questions about lattices, which may not have applications in cryptography, but they have some applications in coding theory. So now you can clear your mind and think about an entirely different topic. So one thing that coding theorists ask of you often is, how many points can there be on a genus G curve over a given finite field? And so in particular, you can define n sub q of g as being the maximal number of points that a genus G curve over fq. And there are many things you can ask about this function. But one of the things you can ask, which is kind of a silly question, but it doesn't have an answer yet, so here's an open problem. For a fixed q, is this an increasing function of a genus? So is it going to be the case that you have a genus 17 curve that has so many points and no genus 18 curve has that many? No. But that tells you how little we know about what happens to this function. But people like to study it, and in fact, people collect lots and lots of data. So van der Heer and van der Vlucht have this semi-annually updated table of the best known results, and here I'm just providing a very small portion of it. They only look at field sizes that are small powers of 2 and 3, actually they go up to 128, but my slide was not wide enough. And they go past genus 10, they go down to genus 50 or so, I think. And they keep track of the best results so far on what is the best upper bound known for the number of points on a GSG curve over FQ. So this is something that Kristen and I worked on a few years ago, trying to improve the methods for getting upper bounds on these quantities. So I think in this portion of the table, there's something like a third of the upper bounds came from this work we did a few years ago. But there's still room for improvement. And we were thinking about this again recently and came up with some new ideas. And you know, it would be nice to apply these new ideas. And in particular, for instance, you might wonder about this point over here. So it might be the case that you could have a curve of genus 7 over F4 with 22 points. And as far as we know, maybe the upper bound for genus 8 is 21.
What does it mean when there's a range given?
Ah, that means that that someone has an example of a curve of genus 21, but they don't have an example of a curve of genus 22.
No,
number
of points.
Yes, number of points, I'm sorry. Okay. There are many examples of a curve of genus 22. they have a curve of genus 7 that has 21 points, but the best upper bound they can prove for the number of points of a genus 7 curve is 22.
But there's only one number there that means you know.
That means you know it. And actually, it might be the case that you might not actually know the curve, but you know there is one. So you'll have to read the fine print on their paper. Actually, I can. Here's the real paper. It goes down, and then there's the tables for p equals 3. And then they have the sources for all of these things. This takes some work to keep track of. So it's nicer to look at a small portion. So Kristen and I have thought of a new technique which we haven't applied everywhere can be applied yet. But unfortunately, one of the first things that we could do was to show that 22 actually can't occur. So we still don't know whether or not this is an increasing function or not. But in order to get rid of this 22, and also we're going to be able to get rid of that 30 and probably some other things as well, in order to use this, we needed to know something about lattices. So let me say something about Hermitian forms. What we could show for that genus 7 curve over F4 case is that if there were a genus 7 curve over F4 with 22 points, we could show that it would give rise to a matrix. 3x3 matrix with entries in the maximal order of Q adjoint square root of minus 7. It's Hermitian, positive definite, and its determinant is 3. So given any genus 7 curve through some technique, which I can go into, we can get this matrix. And what we could, well, and this matrix, of course, defines a Hermitian space over this ring. So you get a rank 3 module over 07, and so it's a lattice. It's a six-dimensional Z lattice that has an action of this ring. And for every vector in this Hermitian space whose squared length is n, I'm not sure of the common notations here, so sometimes people take square roots of inner products, and I don't want to take a square root, so I'm calling it the squared length. For every vector of squared length n in this space, you can show that you get a degree n map from this hypothetical curve to an elliptic curve over F4 that happens to have eight. The connection is that an 8-point elliptic curve over that field has CM by that order. So that's something that's going to happen. And the observation to make is that if M has a vector whose squared length is 2, then C doesn't exist. Because if you have a degree 2 map from a curve with 22 points to a curve with 8 points, then something is going wrong. So we were in this situation where we wanted to show that any matrix like this gives rise to a short vector. And we were actually able to do this with a small amount of computation. We could show that every positive definite Hermitian M in this matrix ring, whose determinant was 3, has a vector whose squared length is 1 over 2. Maybe I should mention that if you view this Hermitian space as a quadratic space, as a lattice over Z6, as a regular lattice, then the usual short vector bound is 3. So you can't just say it's a lattice and the short vector is like 3 because you want 1 or 2. So the problem, the open problem I want to specify is, given an, let's make life easy, an imaginary quadratic principal ideal domain O, given a determinant D, find a way of getting sharp upper bounds on the length of short vectors in n-dimensional Hermitian spaces of determinant D. So we're able to deal with small 3x3 cases and very small 4x4 cases, and we can also deal with the case when the determinant happens to be a norm from O. But aside from these cases, computationally, you don't know quite how to go about doing this efficiently. And it seems, I don't know anything about lattices, so it seems that this should be something that people have studied, and there should be an answer in a 150-year-old paper somewhere. So if there is some nice theory of Minkowski constants for these things, then I would like to